Hello and welcome to Drawing Blood. I'm Emma Merkling.
And I'm Christy Slobogan.
And today we're talking about the 2022 film Crimes of the Future by Canadian director David Cronenberg. And we get into a lot of different things.
We talk about
performance art. We talk about surgery as sex. We talk about the cosmetic gaze and pain and the cyborg, Darwin, evolution, the relationship between art and reality, media theory, the body and technology, so much in this episode.
And with all those topics, of course, we have a couple of content warnings for this episode. We talk about the death and the murder of a child that happens in the film. We talk a lot about bodily pain in a lot of detail. We talk about surgery and body modification and viscera and organs. So there's a lot of the inner parts of the body that gets described in this film. And the act of cutting into the body gets described a lot in this episode. And so let's get into it.
We always say that. It's so annoying.
So Crimes of the Future is one of those movies where as soon as the trailer came out and as soon as it was, you know, floating around the internet, people kept sending it to me and being like, have you seen this trailer? Are you going to see this movie? When it was out, like, have you seen this yet? Was it terrifying?
Yeah.
Like, because all the taglines are like, it's horror, it's surgery as sex, performance art. And so I had all these people. Okay. And by all these people, I mean like four. But still,
that's a lot.
That's a lot of people to send you a movie trailer. So I didn't watch it in theaters, but I ended up, you know, I think I watched it about a year and a half ago. And immediately I was like, oh, this is definitely a Drawing Blood episode.
Yeah. And we've been wanting to do a Cronenberg episode for a really long time.
Exactly. And I was like, okay, perfect. But I actually think that this is unlike maybe our Midsommar episode or our Ra or Kav episode. I actually think, and let me know if you agree with me, I think that this is one of those movies that it would benefit to listen to this episode first and then watch the film. I actually found it much better to watch the second time, Crimes of the Future, because the first time,
too.
Like there's so much world building and there's so much philosophy in it. And even the murkiness, the darkness of this dingy future that it's set in, it's hard to parse the first time. And so I actually think that, well, I hope that we will be helpful to people who want to watch this, because I found it quite difficult to organize in my brain the first time I watched it.
I think it's also, it's a late Cronenberg film. I mean, he's now like 80-something. I think, and he's been making films since the 70s. So if, like me, you're a stan, because I've seen a lot of Cronenberg films before, and so I could weight certain things more heavily than others, but definitely there were like aspects of plot that the first time I watched, at the end I was like, wait, what? Especially the end. And then the second time I was like, oh, there's still bits that I can't quite figure out.
I know, there are a couple of characters that I'm like, I'm not sure what you're doing here, but I like you. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think that hopefully us pulling apart some of those major themes, like the very typical Cronenberg themes and some of the ones that are particular to this film, could be helpful for folks wanting to watch it. So as we usually do, the person who is being brought the object does the description, the visual analysis, all of that. It's a little bit more in depth and a little bit harder to do with a film, but do you want to just go ahead and kind of give our listeners a feel of general plot? What does the film look like? What's going on?
Yeah.
What can they expect with Crimes of the Future?
Okay. I'm going to try get through all of this and I'm going to try keep it concise and not go on too many little divergences. So,
but you know, if we do, it is what it is. It's what happens.
I was like, I'm not going to try get too granular. Opening shot. A ship is on its side.
Yeah.
You know. No, but okay.
Frame by frame.
So Crimes of the Future, which shares a title with a Cronenberg film from like 1970 or super, super early, but doesn't have anything else in common with it, in case you were confused about that like I was. And the crimes in question seem to be related to what is happening to the body at this point. So it's set in, I would say, although it's never explicitly articulated, the near future. The vibe of the film is sort of, it seems to be set in Greece. Based on, I mean, the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, maybe vaguely Mediterranean, like it's sort of a bit warm, a bit dusty, a bit run down. The second time I noticed that a lot of the shop names and stuff are in Greek on the outside, but all the people who inhabit it are sort of, they have accents from a bunch of different places. There's a mix of races, there's a mix of ethnicities. I don't know if everyone has had to end up in one place because of some sort of catastrophe, but that is the vibe. It's very run down. The opening shot is of a massive cruise ship on its side, although that's never sort of returned to. And then, as we'll get into, there are lots of technologies in the film that feel very futuristic in interesting
ways. But like dingy futuristic.
Yeah, and also like there's a there's discussion in the film about things being old. Like there are technicians who update this technology, but it's like, oh, that's our old model, you know, that people are still using, that people are hacking into. So in a way, it's also like production of things has maybe slowed down. Like, anyway. So the opening shot of the film is this little boy who's playing in the sand, and a woman who we discover is his mother in a little bit comes out and says, I don't want you eating anything in there, meaning the ocean. And this little boy runs inside. And then the next thing he does is he's eating this plastic waste paper basket, and his mother watches on. And then within the first, I want to say like minute of the film is, I think, the most horrifying scene of the whole film, in which she smothers him to death.
Yep. Yep.
It's funny because I don't find it a particularly horrifying movie. I don't find it particularly scary. I don't even find it particularly pessimistic, but it is a horrific opening scene. This woman then calls her husband and she's like, oh, this creature, this thing of yours, his corpse is here. Come and pick him up. The next thing, we have the sort of cold open onto what we will discover is one of the main characters. So basically the film is set around these two main characters who are performance artists, Saul Tenser and Caprice. The opening shot of Saul Tenser, he's in this strange rocking cradle bed that at first glance is like a walnut, but like a little bit more fleshy. And this is very typical of the tech in this film. Like it's sort of quasi-biological, quasi-natural, and it's holding onto him, like the little nodes that are attached to his body are like little hands, and it's sort of rocking him. And there's this groaning, almost animal sound coming from it. But Caprice walks in, all chill. So we get a sense that, you know, for a second, you're like, oh my God, is it eating him? But nope, this is just normal. This is normal life. And basically this object, it turns out, is a bed that has been designed to anticipate pain. So Saul Tenser feels pain, and the bed is meant to move to like figure out how to adjust his body so that he doesn't feel pain anymore. And one thing we will discover as the film goes on is that it's unusual that Saul feels pain, because in this near future, according to this guy who we'll meet shortly, pain has all but disappeared. There's very few people who still feel it.
There are a lot of things in this world that evolve out of this lack of pain. Like at some point, someone talks about desktop surgery happening, because if there's no pain and no infection, as we'll find out, you can do things that are definitely not possible in our real world.
Yeah. And so I think within the first few minutes of the film, a lot of the themes of the film are set up. So immediately Saul and Caprice start talking about their art project. And what their art project is, it transpires, is an organ that is growing inside Saul. So actually this opening scene, I was thinking, feels quite like a pregnancy. Like she's like, there's a new hormone in your bloodstream, and she's really excited. And he's like, oh my God. And it's like, he's creating something. He's growing something in his belly that is going to take on a life of its own. And what we discover their practice is that live in front of an audience, Saul gets put into this machine that's like an autopsy bed, and Caprice, who is manipulating this very organic, almost toad-like control, starts cutting into his body and revealing this organ, which she tattoos through sort of microsurgery beforehand, linking already to a lot of themes we've talked about in other episodes. And then she surgically removes this organ during the performance. And during the first performance, we see there are these screens in the background that declare body is reality. And that, I think, is not only a big theme in this film, but I think is crucial to understanding Cronenberg in general, as I'm sure we'll get into.
Sure.
To try and cut a long story short, this process of tattooing the organs has been taken up by a very secret new sort of registry office called, mm-hmm. do you remember what it's called? Like the Organ Registry? National Organ Registry, which is part of a larger state body called New Vice Unit. Later on, we discover that they're called that because calling themselves the Evolutionary Derangement Unit wasn't sexy enough, which I think is super interesting because sex, we will also see, is a big theme of this film. Basically, this process that Caprice has developed for tattooing on the organs is now getting taken up by this secret new registration office, which is about to, as a sort of tool of state control, declare that everyone with new organs needs to register them. Because we quite quickly discover the problem at the heart of this society, which is that the problem is defined by the state, I should say, at the heart of this society, which is that people are growing a bunch of organs inside them that have no known use, and that we are, according to the state, mm-hmm. teetering, veering away from the path of the human. And mm-hmm. there is a fear that these are called sort of evolutionary crimes. So there's a sense that we are evolving, although the state is not allowed to say that word, which I think is quite interesting, because evolution implies, I think, progression. And they're seeing this as really devolution, right. You know.
Degeneration, yeah.
Exactly. Away from the path of the human through this profusion of internal organs. And what we will come to discover is that that little boy who was murdered by his mother is one of these individuals who is growing these new organs. But in that little boy's case, a purpose for the organs has been discovered. They have a known function, which is that they seem to be able to digest plastic. So there's this state that's trying to suppress any knowledge of them and to sort of mark them as tumors that need to be cut out. That's on one extreme of the spectrum. On the other extreme of the spectrum is this almost anarchist group that is voluntarily undergoing surgeries to retain these organs and to make them function, to almost accelerate this process, to make them able to consume something called synth, like synthetic materials, plastic, toxic waste. And the child who died, Brecken, was the first quote-unquote natural-born child to
miracle
be able to,
child,
miracle child who has a whole system of organs. Because up until this point, because people keep cutting these organs out, it seems we haven't known what these organs can do or might do. There's just a panic that they are making us not human. And then there's in between these groups, I think, are two sort of intermediary groups. One is these archivists who we discover, one of them at least, is into this thing called the Inner Beauty Pageant, which is this mm-hmm. secret, possibly illegal group who is all about retaining the organs, not for the same reasons as the plastic eaters, to sort of put them to some purpose, but as an inner beauty pageant. Like they want to celebrate the beauty of the quote unquote natural processes of the body. They don't want the organs cut out. And then hovering somewhere between these spectrums are the artists who are, in Caprice's terms, trying to make meaning out of this chaos inside the body. And I think that the role of artists is really important in this film and in this sort of world.
Definitely. The role of artists is really important, and I want to talk about that a lot. And I think it's really interesting that the National Organ Registry folks, who are like these kind of scuttling little bureaucrats, is how they're kind of
insects,
portrayed.
They're called.
Yeah. Insects. And Kristen Stewart is one of them, and she does such a great job, I think, at being
she's so good
of,
in
like,
this
awkward, unsettling bureaucrat. But it's really interesting because they are so enamored with the work that the artists are doing, and performance artists take this like massively important role in the society. Like they are the celebrities. So the fact that this government entity took inspiration from performance artists who might be thought of as more on the anarchy side of things, right? Like anti-capitalist perhaps. But then to be like inspiration for a government body is really interesting.
And also thinking about the political in the broadest possible sense of that meaning, not party politics, but like politics in the biggest possible sense. What is the politics of art and what should the politics of art be? Because one thing that we're shown quite clearly in this film is the ways that art can be co-opted by the far right or the state. And this mm-hmm. is basically the culmination of the film, or sort of the climax, ends up being that these plastic eaters, these people who I keep thinking of as accelerationists, who modified their internal organs, one of them, who's the father of this child, Brecken, asks Saul and Caprice to do, as part of an art performance, a public autopsy of his son's organs, because he wants to reveal to the world the new future. The future is now, and this future is a synthesis of technology and humanity, where we come to feed on our own excess. We control our own consumption by developing, by evolving to eat our own waste, basically. And spoiler, this is the bit where skip ahead 15 seconds if you don't want to hear the spoiler. But spoiler is that when the body is cut open, what is revealed is not this magical, miraculous system, but in fact that the government has gotten there first and has already replaced the system with other organs that have been tattooed by one of these bureaucrats.
Right. And I think just one more thing that I want to add to this description, the plastic eaters, I mean, they do modify their own body. So they're not all growing their own digestive systems like Brecken, the child, did. They're being surgically modified as well. So there's a mix of intervention and evolution, like quote unquote natural evolution. But also the plastic that they're eating is symbolized by these bright purple bars. And I think it's also really interesting that that is like the one really bright point of color in this whole film, which is very like neutral, dingy, murky. And these bright purple bars that represent toxic waste, essentially, put into plastic form is the one thing, the most unnatural looking thing in the whole film. Totally. And yet it's that thing that so many of these people can eat without pain, which we'll get to.
One thing I just want to add to that summary before we move on is, I think a really key moment is Timlin, one of these bureaucrats, this archivist, comes to see the performance of Saul and Caprice where she cuts his organ out. And she comes up to him timidly afterwards and she says, "What you were doing was sex, right?" And he's like, "What do you mean?" And she's like, "Well, you showed me that surgery is the new sex. That when I saw you cutting into Caprice, I wanted you to be cutting into me."
Or when Caprice was cutting into you.
Yeah. Yes, sorry. And this is a huge theme throughout the film where they are constantly, one thing I didn't mention is there are sort of these sort of sleazy alleyways where you have like couples and thruples who are in the throes of what looks like sex, and then you realize they're actually cutting into each other's flesh. This is a theme that extends way back in Cronenberg, such as in films like Crash, one of my all-time favorites. Sex is an important theme within evolution, right? And I think that this film's approach to sex, which is something that is cutting rather than quote-unquote biological reproduction, shows what the film, where the film positions itself in some of these apparent binaries of like nature and culture, subject and object, self and other, human and technology, and how it works to break down those binaries. And I think that that's huge for Cronenberg.
Absolutely. And, you know, this idea of sex's role in evolution, thinking about the fact that Brecken was the quote unquote miracle child, even though a lot of his father had surgically altered his body, and yet he ended up having this new digestive system that could break down plastic, it's much more of a like Lamarckian type of evolution where acquired characteristics through surgery can potentially be passed on. Like, yes, even at the kind of genetic level, surgery becomes the new sex, where genetic material can potentially be passed on through surgery, which is really fascinating. But yeah, so, I mean, we've already talked a bit about David Cronenberg and we'll get into a lot of his themes. But yeah, he was born in 1943, massive filmmaker and writer, often thought of as a master of body horror, you know, which is, I was like, okay, how can I get a really succinct definition of body horror? And I think it's just fear of the body, fear of its porousness, your lack of control of your own body, and kind of this idea that living in a body can be just as terrifying as death.
I would add the fear and the pleasures. I think that that's a super important theme in body horror.
Absolutely.
Because it's the horror and the pleasure, and it's always both.
Yeah, and it's like this corporeal thing has the capacity to be like the most painful object and the most pleasurable, like within your lived experience. So that's what he's known as. And as I was doing reading for this episode, I kept stumbling upon all of these nicknames for Cronenberg, which I thought were pretty cringe and hilarious. Baron of Blood, bad. King of horror, master of venereal horror, and the godfather of body horror. So I did write down men, exclamation point, right next to all of those names, because it's giving the same
men
vibe
and
as,
hierarchy.
Yes.
Like men it's and like hierarchy. Godfather, Baron,
yes, exactly.
King.
And it's giving the same vibe as like throughout the history of medicine or history in general, where it's like the father of such and such, you know,
for sure.
The father of surgery, the father of like this type of medicine, the father of blah, blah, blah. It's very patriarchal. Anyway, and he's definitely this filmmaker who, you know, a lot of his works have been kind of controversial, especially when they get funded by the government, which that kind of relates to a lot of these anarchist or governmental themes in Crimes of the Future. Like Crash from 1996 was definitely an example where people were kind of up in arms about Canadian taxpayer money having gone to this because he's Canadian, he was born in Toronto. So he came up with the idea of Crimes of the Future, this Crimes of the Future. As we said, there was another Crimes of the Future from 1970, no relation whatsoever. But he came up with the idea for this in the 90s, which is when he was making a lot of his like very classic, very Cronenbergian thematically, I mean, films that people most think of when they think of Cronenberg, right? So that's why a lot of people are like, oh, this is a return to form, when a lot of the ideas are coming from that time. I also think that it's really interesting that even though it was thought of in the 90s, like a lot of the themes, especially kind of the apocalyptic eco stuff, has so much resonance for the 2020s. Like it just shows kind of a continuity. Like a lot of his themes are always going to be relevant, but they feel particularly potent right now. But I found a couple of quotes, one from 1978 and one from 1988, that like directly implant themselves into Crimes of the Future, which is really cool. In 1978, he had an idea for a quote, a beauty contest for the inside of the body. That's literally in Crimes of the Future. So it shows he's been thinking about these things for a long time. And then in 1988, he said that we've not developed an aesthetic for the inside of the body, but if you develop an aesthetic for it, it ceases to be ugly. And so that's showing like, okay, it's becoming art in Crimes of the Future very clearly.
Yeah. And as the timing of the comment suggests, a comment on what he's trying to do, on what he does with his art in general, that there is this theme of the monstrous as art, pain as pleasure, you know, surgery is the new sex.
The things that are typically hidden away as well, like the insides of your body, like being on display in really potent and interesting ways.
Yeah, performance.
Performance, yes, exactly. Operating theater, that's a massive part of this. And then just to wrap up this really brief background, and to connect with like his ideas about what body horror is, I just wanted to give two quick quotes from him. I read a lot of David Cronenberg interviews to kind of lead us into our first big theme, perhaps. So again, thinking about like the primacy of the body, he says, "For me, the first fact of human existence is the human body. This is the most real fact we have. The further from your own body you get, the less real everything is, the less verifiable, the less you connect with it. But if you embrace the reality of the human body, you are embracing your own mortality," which I see that in kind of the hope at the end of the film, perhaps like these people are embracing the way that their bodies are evolving in a way that like melds with human technology. Because another quotation that I think is interesting to get us into this main theme is that he says, "I see technology as an extension of the human body." And so there's that tension of like, okay, it makes total sense in Cronenberg's world, but there's that tension of like, okay, the human body is full reality, but also technology is extension of human body. So like, how do you mesh those two things to then become like the Cronenbergian reality?
It's interesting to me that you see the film as ending on a hopeful note, because I think it ends on this quite ambiguous note, but I agree that it's hopeful, but it's not clear whether he's dying or being reborn. But I think that because Cronenberg is obsessed with, I want to say the death drive, but I don't mean it in its Freudian sense. I think we are very much in a non-psychoanalysis, non-Freud world here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that sense that is in Freud where he says, like, on some level, all life is also pursuing death, that there's this drive in us towards dissolution, taking oneself apart. And I think that in films like Crash, that theme is hyper explicit. Crash is a film, just shorthand, in which this group of people discover that they have a sexual fetish for getting in car crashes. And there's this like sexual openness, firstly, in terms of like they're all non-monogamous, and the ways they have sex in even like the wounds that are opened up by these car crashes, mm-hmm, which I think is very related to this film.
Which happens in Crimes of the Future, yeah.
Exactly. But the sense of wounding and wanting, like having car crashes is like every time you risk dying and that you're always hurtling right. towards death, I think is a key theme. And so it could be both that whether he's dying or not, it is a hopeful ending.
Right. And we should say like what exactly happens at the end. So throughout the film, we've seen, or at least once, we've seen someone try to eat the purple plastic bar who wasn't evolved for it. And they immediately like choke and die. Right? Like if you can't digest this, you can't digest it and it's toxic yeah. waste. What happens at the very end of the film, the last part of the film, he's in his breakfaster chair, right? That's what that semi-organic technology that helps him to eat, much like the bed that yeah. you described, but it looks bony and it's creepy, but it's like, yeah, semi-organic, this moaning, creaking, bony chair that helps him to eat. So he's in that chair and he finally, it's like he's fed up with trying to eat quote-unquote normal, quote-unquote natural human food, right? And the last scene is that he takes a bite of one of those plastic bars that the anarchist evolutionists or assisted evolutionists, I suppose, have been creating. And so I really read his last facial expression, which again, you know, the lines between pleasure and pain, bliss and death are perhaps more porous in Cronenberg. But anyway, I read his facial expression as soon as he's taken this bite. The breakfaster chair stops. So it's no longer needing to anticipate his pain because he's no longer having pain. And that could either be because he's dying or because he's finally able to digest something without pain. And so I read his facial expression as calm, finally, like something has worked. So that to me, I'm like, oh, at the end of the film, we find out that he has also evolved. Like in a way, like that was his problem throughout this film. All that pain that he was feeling was actually this new way of digesting.
The pain came not from these growths, but from him resisting the growths, basically.
Exactly.
Is that reading?
And that's very much like the first quote from Cronenberg, where like you should be embracing that reality, the reality of your body. And that's, I see that quotation coming to fruition in that very last scene in Crimes of the Future.
Except, and I think that this relates to technology, what the human is I think one of the key questions and yes. horrors in this film and in other films.
Yes.
The relation of the body to that is key, and the relation of technology to all of those things is also key. And the way I actually read that last scene was in kind of a Deleuze and Guattari way. The rest of the film is all through the sort of, I think almost entirely, or if not entirely, filmed almost like the view from nowhere. You're not thinking about the filmmaker when you're watching the film. But the very last shot, what we see is Caprice filming his face and zooming in on his face in black and white. And yes. the last shot of the film is this. He almost looks like the ecstasy of Saint Teresa. Like his head is up. He's got tears rolling out of his eyes. He's looking into this light. But that's exactly like Deleuze and Guattari, as I think we've mentioned in other episodes, talk about the problems of trying to read the face, especially in cinema, especially in these cinematic close-ups, as easily legible, as signifying something. And instead, they see it as one of the places where the self is, a site from which the self can be productively escaped and deterritorialized. And I sort of read that last scene as a warning against trying to read it one way or another. But I think he dances that line like very finely. And you can argue it both ways.
The way that he described that very end of Crimes of the Future was hope and transcendence. And so Ecstasy of Saint Teresa is definitely that transcendent moment, you know, and I think he was talking about this in terms of like the eco-horror side of it. Yeah, what if we could digest plastic? Like that would actually solve a lot of problems in this world, which is perhaps, you know, that's simplifying it too much for everything that's going on in this film. But he has talked about it in terms of hope, which you're right, there are multiple readings of it, but that's the one that takes primacy for me.
But I guess I agree on the hope. I think I just disagree about whether he's dying or, you know, digesting it.
Oh, really? Okay.
I must admit, I've never made any effort to read anything by Cronenberg about his own work. And so I think that there's a huge possibility that how I understand his work reads against how he himself would understand it.
Which is totally fine. Like, that's what art is.
The way that I feel like I understand Cronenberg, the thing that I think Cronenberg is interested in is this idea of sort of becoming cyborg. and the horrors and the pleasures that are opened up by this. And by cyborg, I mean something very specific in Donna Haraway's sense. But before I explain what that is, you said that, you know, he has said that he sees technology as an extension of the body. So when he was an undergrad, Michael McLuhan, who's like one of the fathers, shade intended, of sort of media studies, media theory, was teaching at the time. And McLuhan has some of the most influential writing on media and media ecologies from the 20th century.
Yes.
And he talks about technology as being like a prosthesis of the human, right? Mm-hmm. That like a prosthesis, like an extension of the body, but one that then, that we both become attached to and that changes us. So yes, it's quite a deterministic reading of technology.
Yeah. So do you think, would you say, in terms of like the Cronenberg quote that I just said about technology being the extension of the body, would you say, and I think this is what I think, that Cronenberg is saying it's much more than a prosthesis, like it's not something just added on? Yes. Okay.
Yes. And this is where we get to sort of cyborg stuff.
Yeah.
I think in McLuhan's reading, it's not a cyborg reading. It's this, it's a very Western reading. It's like man picks up tool, man hits thing with tool, tool is extension of man. And there's been a lot of pushback against that, notably by Marxists like Raymond Williams, who see that as like an oversimplistic view. But I always think of that scene in Videodrome where his hand becomes a gun.
Yeah,
the hand. Where hand, like basically in the plot of Videodrome, ugh, how do I summarize it? I don't remember if it's the state or some big corporation, same diff, I think, for Cronenberg, but it's trying to control his body and its mutations. And he ends up letting those mutations become something else and not quite like taking control over them, but making them work for him. And there's one scene where his hand becomes a gun and he like, I think, shoots them.
And that's probably the most like literal film where it's technology becoming an extension of the body. Yeah,
That's his McLuhan film, I think. But I think where Cronenberg takes us, he's a bit like, instead of being quite so deterministic, he's a bit like, let's see. Like, what happens if we sort of pursue this line of thought? What happens if we start thinking about the mutual implications of the body and technology? And I think that evolution is one of the cues into this in the film, that the bodies that I end up seeing in his film are closer to Donna Haraway's understanding of cyborgs. And Haraway's, to give it a brief gloss, this comes mostly from the Cyborg Manifesto, but it's something she continues thinking with, and to use her phrase, sort of staying with right up into the present, you know, is more interested in this sort of co-becoming with technology between the biological organism, between technology, and between like human and animal. So she's interested in breaking down, she's working against identity politics, and she's working against Western dualism. This Western insistence on the binary has led to a false sense that we are split between mind and body, between human and animal, between technology and human. And instead, we are all already cyborg, that it becomes impossible and useless to start differentiating where technology ends and we begin, you know, especially in our modern cybernetic age with the computer and how they work on us and how we work with them. It becomes futile to start differentiating between these things. And not only does it become futile, if we embrace the monstrosity of the cyborg, if we start pushing against some of these prescribed fixed notions of identity, if we start building relationships through kin and affinity with other forms of being, rather than just like our reproductive children or with like identity groups, then we begin to be able to move against like Western heteropatriarchal capitalism.
I think that this links back to the surgery as sex thing and like the evolution thing, because it's not just your reproductive children, the children that you reproduce. Like, that's not the only way that you're able to mix genetics and like keep pushing the species forward, right? But there's also this writer, he talks about sex in Cronenberg as a type of remixing. So like sex feeds into that cyborg creation, where like through sex in Cronenberg, you become something else. You get remixed with another being, with another species, with like, he talks about The Fly a bit, which is Cronenberg's 1986 film, where the scientist gets remixed with the fly, and then
a very hot Jeff Goldblum.
Yes. Very young Jeff Goldblum. It's a whole thing. That was a revelation for me, not gonna lie, watching Jeff Goldblum in that. I was like, oh, okay.
You're like, I get it.
Yeah. But anyway, so like this idea that okay, yes, melding with technology in Cronenberg can also happen through sex. Because if surgery is sex, then like that all is happening in the same process, right? It's not fully quote unquote natural or organic or biological. It's not fully technological or inorganic or unnatural. Like these things are smushed together to allow for this like pushing the human body into higher plane isn't really what I want, but like a different plane. You know what I mean?
Yes. And I think the way that I see this fitting in is that the reason that Haraway is setting up this figure of the cyborg is precisely because it questions the human and therefore it questions all the political stuff that comes with it. And I think in general, one of the themes that shoots right throughout Cronenberg's oeuvre is that, like, including in Crimes of the Future, the state, the system are failures, right?
They're absolutely.
In Crimes of the Future, they're literally just there to try and label, diagnose, and control. And the state is literally just existing to, the state is the thing that is clinging to this concept of the human that Haraway is so against, that I think Cronenberg is against. What he's interested instead is what in Videodrome is called the new flesh, which is the body, not the human body, but the body. And that body is like in becoming with other bodies and creatures and things and techniques.
Right. And there's one reading of Crimes of the Future by Keith Booker, which is like the organs growing inside the body. He reads it as nature fighting back against the imposed human hierarchies, like, which I'm not sure that I fully agree with, but he's like, this is obviously humans have totally decimated this world. It's post-apocalyptic. Like the environment is dead. Like you never see anything green or any animals in this film, like not even a fly.
Yeah.
Not any pets, anything running around. Like it's only grunge and humans. And so his reading is that like we can see these organs as nature reasserting itself, taking control back from the humans. Like if humans have inserted themselves into nature in this way that corrupted it, then it's like going the opposite direction, going inside of humans. I don't know.
I think I would disagree. And I think I don't want to say Cronenberg would disagree, but in my reading of Cronenberg, his films disagree in that that does still suggest that humanity is in some way separate from nature have created an unnatural world, when part of the point, I think, of a lot of this stuff is like nature is non-identical with itself. Like to begin to split nature and culture is part of the problem. This is nature and its culture. It's us.
I think a lot of Cronenberg is like, also humans aren't special within that huge ecosystem. Like there's nothing, you know, so much of humanism of art is like trying to pinpoint the things about humanity, about creativity that is unique and special. And over again in his films, I think he's showing like, nope, we share all this DNA with flies. We, you know, are not that different from, as you said, you know, the rest of the ecosystem, the rest of nature.
Yeah. And also the merging of technology with us too, like those very biological machines that are in Crimes of the Future, their fleshiness, their boniness, you know, that, yeah, not just other organisms, but are like co-becomings with other things and other entities as part of this post-humanist, post-modern being.
So then do you think the performance art in Crimes of the Future, like, do you think the artists are these figures who are then denying that entanglement by always taking out the organs? Like,
no.
No?
No, I think that the figure that we are called to identify with is Saul.
Yes, of course.
But I also think that by the end of the film, it's also Caprice. And I think a lot about one of the very last scenes, which I think is incredibly beautiful, is so Saul can feel pain. We know this from the beginning. But I think Caprice goes, I think they both go through a journey in the film as they discover more about the plastic eaters, as they discover more about themselves. You know, Caprice has this side quest where she goes to see this performance artist who is cutting into her face. And then Caprice says, you made me want to be open. And she says, open metaphorically, open artistically. Yep, but she also means open physically, because then she gets cut and she gets these body modifications put into her face.
Yep.
And there's this moment near the end of the film, after they've also gone through this whole journey, the camera's panning. We hear noises that sound like sex. They're like moaning and groaning. And then what we discover is that Saul Tenser and Caprice, they're having a nightmare, and there's a hint that they're having the same nightmare, because she says, were you dreaming about Dutrice, this plastic eater character? And he says, yes. And he looks kind of surprised. And she says, yeah. I almost thought I was feeling. And it's he's in such pain that she almost seems mm-hmm. to be taking on his pain. And I think it's this like right. the blending of their subjectivities. They don't become one, but they share, they cross some, there's some transmission that has happened in terms of right. Their yeah, selves absolutely. And their experiences. I think that the film thinks that art can do quite a lot. That's the autopsy scene, right? Art is what cuts open the body, opens it up and yeah. shows us the chaos inside and isn't scared to look at the chaos. It can be misappropriated, for instance, by the state, or it can become the site of radical investigation, radical, I don't know about meaning creation, but showing us stuff so that we create meaning.
And I think that that's, I mean, really simply and kind of in a shorthand way pointed towards, again, I already mentioned, like the status that these performance artists have. Like everybody is going to these mm-hmm. kind of clubby scenes to go watch these performance artists, these people cut into themselves, sew up themselves, perform autopsies on children's corpses. Like it is the highest level of kind of culture and meaning making in this world. And, you know, the operating theater, like that phrase is taking on so much meaning in this film. And then, you know, the autopsy tool, the SARC at one point, Caprice describes the autopsy machine, the SARC, as her paintbrush. And so it's this yeah. like, again, we've talked a lot about boundaries dissolving here. And so the boundaries between art and science are dissolving, but also the boundaries between human, animal, and inanimate are dissolving in these performance art pieces. The two scuttling bureaucrats watch one of Saul and Caprice's performances. And this is after when they're talking about Saul and Caprice's artwork. Whippet, the man, says, you know, when they're talking about discovering Saul's new organs, he says it's like discovering a new species of animal. Again, in a world where there are no animals, apparently. And then Timlin, the Kristen Stewart character, said, well, more like discovering a new Picasso. And so in yeah. I love in that like little bit of dialogue, that collapsing of the animal, the human, and the artistic, it just all becomes like equivalent in a way.
There's lots of discussions of art and like philosophies of art in the film. Lots of little moments yes. where like I think different
oh, absolutely.
Positions on it are being like yes. expressed.
And I love that then the government actor, the new vice detective, it's then the classic thing that always gets asked of like conceptual art or performance art in any world. But in this one, it also appears, he's like, well, how can a tumorous growth, again, calling it tumorous, how can a tumorous growth be considered art? Where's the emotional shaping? That's the basis of all art. And it's like very clear that, okay, it's the government that is like pushing back on the meaning that clearly so many people are getting out of this. Like I said, that's always the question that's asked of the conceptual, the postmodern, the avant-garde, et cetera. So there's a lot of art history in this, weirdly.
There is. All performance art is huge in this world, but not all performance art is created equal.
Yes.
And then do you want to talk about the guy with the ears?
Yes.
Because Saul
okay.
has this line where he says, it was okay if you like escapist propaganda.
Right. Yes, I want to talk about the other two. And I actually think that Cronenberg is throwing shade on a real performance artist, is my theory. I feel like there are, you know, we said there's a lot of art history in this, all of the different interpretations of Caprice and Saul's work, and even the fact that like Saul gets all the credit for it, even though Caprice, the woman in this performance art couple, like often isn't thought of as the artist, which I find really interesting. And she doesn't, you know, get a last name. But so basically in this film, you've got Caprice and Saul as the main performance artists. And then there are two in particular other performances that we watch in the film. One is Odile, the woman who gets plastic surgery on her face, like decorative plastic surgery that isn't the typical, you know, in our world where you get plastic surgery to beautify, to like get yeah. your lips filled, get your nose straightened, get your cheeks implanted, that kind of thing. She gets these jagged lines cut into her face. And she, to me, is a representation of Orlan, the performance artist, who I'll get to in a second. And then Klinek is the other performance that we watch in this film. And he is the man with, it's often shown as like the big scary scene in the film, even though it's not scary, but it's like one of the yeah. grossest, I guess. It's this man and he's got ears all over his body. And he is definitely a stand-in for the performance artist Stellark. And he's a real person who does a lot of work with ears. And at one point, somebody who's watching this performance I mean, you already said the thing that Saul Tensor says, right? Like, if you like escapist propaganda, fine. But the person he's talking to says, yeah, 1,000 ears is not good design. And I'm like, okay, there's no way that Cronenberg was not thinking of this performance artist who is known for his work with ears. And that's not a connection.
I think it's a really brilliant observation of yours that this is like the Orlan thing, especially. I didn't think about it.
I'll start with Orlan because I think that's the simpler of the two. So Odile is this woman who's getting these plastic surgeries. And Orlan is this real life living French performance artist who's most well known for this piece that she started on the 30th of May in 1990, but it was a series of surgeries, and it's called The Reincarnation of Saint Orlan. We mentioned her very briefly in our Dental Phantoms episode, but in this surgery, she is again mixing surgery and art, mixing the body as medium with the scalpel as paintbrush, much like how Caprice is thinking about the autopsy tool as her paintbrush. But she gets these surgeries in kind of like a Zeuxian sense to get different body parts from different famous pieces of art to create the ideal face. So, you know, she gets Mona Lisa's forehead done, Botticelli's Venus's chin, the eyes of Gerard's Psyche, like piecemeal surgeries to make herself a work of art, but not just one work of art, a combination of all of them.
A composite.
And so through this, like, obviously when you get plastic surgery, you're deformed at first. Like, there's swelling, there's blood, it's horrible. So it's this, like, she's always saying that it's not, the goal isn't to be beautiful. It's to, like, tease out the differences and the overlaps between the monstrous and the feminine, the beautiful and the hideous, the human and the like, cyborg, the surgical. And one of the things that I was thinking about with watching the Odile performance in Crimes of the Future is like, okay, what is the major difference between Orlan and Odile, where there is pain in our world, right? And so Orlan has to constantly be, pretending is the wrong word, but she's constantly working against this idea that she is experiencing pain. So there's always like these bright colors in her performances. You know, she emphasizes the joy and the pleasure of these surgeries, which is what's actually happening in Crimes of the Future. And, you know, Odile says, like, it took me a long time to find a surgeon who would do this. And that was also the case for both Orlan and Stellark. And pain is a big problem in these kinds of performance arts because it's seen as, like, grotesque or, like, why would you put your body through that? Whereas in Crimes of the Future, that is kind of taken away, which I find really interesting.
By some and not by others. And we never know for whom.
The performance art of Odile is very different from the performance art of Saul Tensor because Odile seemingly does not feel pain and Saul does. So this question of pain in performance art is a really interesting one.
Yeah.
For sure.
And I spent this weekend thinking a lot about what pain is doing in the film. Like, why does it matter? The story in many ways would still work if they can feel pain. It made me think, I read this really good book a little while ago called Victorian Pain by Rachel Ablow. So the chapter on Darwin, I think, is really good. And I think it ties a lot into a lot of the evolutionary themes in this film, because we are told off the top, but by one of the sort of foil characters, I think one of the bureaucrats, one of the characters we're not supposed to over-identify with or take their word, he gives us the sort of classic reading of pain, right? Which is like, well, pain serves an evolutionary purpose. Like, pain has a telos, it has a meaning, it has a cause, and it's almost one for one, right? Why does it cause pain when you put your hand in a fire? Because fire does damage to the body, and therefore we've evolved through natural selection to, like, withdraw our hand away from the source of the fire. But this is not a given, and this is not actually how pain works. And, you know, the classic text on pain is Elaine Scarry, and her whole bit, if I remember correctly, is like, you know, the pain is the one thing that is like unknowable to another person. But there's been a lot of work since then really challenging this model of pain, especially models that talk about pain as a social thing, pain as in a construction. And one of the things that I find super interesting about Darwin, you know, talking about like, when we think of evolution, who do we think of? His understanding of pain is very interesting and complex. And he's always slipping between like, it is neither natural nor cultural, that there's always sort of the slippage in between the two. He slips between it being emotional and physiological. And this is happening at a time in the 19th century when anesthesia is becoming a thing for a first time. So like discourses around pain are becoming really important and prominent. Mm-hmm.
Like, particularly in surgical spaces.
Totally. And, you know, she points out that there's this sense, medical doctors push against this sense that we understand the source or the cause or the meaning of pain because we just don't, that it's very clear to practicing doctors that like pain often exceeds what it is warning us about. Anyway, I guess the point with Darwin is just that like for Darwin, always biology and culture are interrelated and not super separable. And that Darwin's vision of evolution is not teleological. It's not following a specific progression and it's not driving towards a certain goal. And Darwin's very interested in the ways in which a lot of things from, we could think of emotions, including pain, a lot mm-hmm. of different things, are allowed to promulgate through evolution, because we tend to forget that more than selecting four specific features, that the natural selection process is more like eliminating ones that don't work, which means that things that don't have a clear reproductive or fitness function, mm-hmm. like let's say queer sexuality, for instance, queer desire, or art, beauty, are allowed to exist and like continue in the world.
And I think it's interesting that in Crimes of the Future, like some of those things that are chosen for, there's this idea that it might be passed on, because once again, if surgery is sex, then those things that aren't evolutionarily like quote unquote necessary could still contribute to the moving along of the human species, quote unquote human.
Yeah, or that more than that, if sex isn't about reproduction,
yeah,
it becomes about something else, and it fits otherwise into this vision of the body and the role of the body that I think Cronenberg is interested in, as something that, as for Darwin, cannot be split neatly into mind, body, emotional, physical, culture, nature, but that is sort of somewhere between the two. I feel like I interrupted you about the ears.
Well, it's one of the reasons that you always get this with body horror films, right, at film previews. But of course, some people walked out of this film and, you know, couldn't stomach it and whatever. But one of the reasons that people walk out is because like what is happening in some of the performance art looks so painful. And so there's that like visceral, almost empathetic visual reaction to like
which seeing, we talked about in relation we've to talked the, about, the French New Extremity films. Yeah.
Yes, we talked about with that. And I don't get that nearly as much with this film, but so with the ear guy, whose name is Clinic, who is definitely a stand-in for the real performance artist Stellark, you know, one of the things that looks the most painful is not necessarily the growths of ears all over his body, although you know, you can imagine if those are sprouting out of your body or being grafted onto your body, perhaps that could be painful. But also just to, I feel like, visually mark that there is no pain in this world, he's also stitched up his mouth and eyes. And like, that's the kind of like, ooh, part of this performance. Yeah. And then he goes and dances like with his many ears. But anyway, so I feel like shade is being thrown on this real performance artist, Stellark. We already mentioned, you know, 1,000 ears is not good design. And yeah, you can like this if you like escapist propaganda. Those are heavy words if people are equating Clinic to this real man. But Stellark is known for his ears. He's got projects called like Extra Ear and Ear on Arm. So that's like one of his big calling cards, right? And the thing that he's known for most, I would say, is Ear on Arm, which is where he had an ear implanted into his forearm. Like Odile in Crimes of the Future said, you know, it took Stellark 10 years to find surgeons who would do this for him. But his idea with Ear on Arm is that he would get this third ear implanted into his arm, and it looks much like some of the ears on Clinic. And the idea, you know, tying in with this melding of the human and the technological, Stellark wants this ear to have Wi-Fi and to have Bluetooth, so that people from all over the world can then hear what he's hearing on this ear. So in a way, it's almost like, well, you would think Cronenberg would be all about that. Like that's, you know, the melding, or like technology is like an extension of the human body. And it's like this artistic way of extending the human body and like making it performance and making it about like the limits or lack of limits of the human. Oh, and Stellark is really inspired by J.G. Ballard, who that author's writing.
Is the author of Crash
and like has hugely inspired Cronenberg. So like there are a lot of overlaps, but clearly Cronenberg is like, this isn't quite Right. Like the concept behind Stellark's ear on arm is not taking this idea of the technological human to a place that's actually interesting or actually like meaningful.
Do you have a thought on why?
Stellark really gives the vibe of like saying that it's all about, you know, creating this accessible, technologically advanced human community, when in reality, he really gives the vibe of like individualist, fame-seeking performance artist who just like wants to shock for the idea of shocking and like not to actually say anything impactful. Like, you know, he says, and this is from his website, Stellark's, he says, the ear on arm project suggests an alternative anatomical architecture, the engineering of a new organ for the body, an available, accessible, and mobile organ. Cool. That sounds great. But the idea of like saying that it's accessible and available when really it's on such a small scale and really just for him feels like counterproductive. Like that idea of the individual and the community like you were just talking about, I feel like it's very myopic in the Stellark world.
Right. I think I agree. And I think that like I was like, maybe it's the key when I was trying to puzzle through what art is for Cronenberg in this film and like why it matters so much, because it clearly does. Like it's the two central figures are artists. And like I said, a late film, I think reflecting on his own work, his own art. Mm-hmm. And two things that I thought of was, one, they keep coming back to this idea of meaning. Like where is meaning located in the body and in the artwork? And then also this political aspect, right? That like, why is that guy... You know, it's escapist because like, what is it doing? What is it saying?
It's not political.
Totally. And if Cronenberg's about cutting things up and opening them, this guy's literally stitching himself shut and like putting things on the surface. It's a politics of the surface. What you see is what you get. Like it doesn't go deep, so to speak. It doesn't go in.
Right. But I feel like Orlan, though, does have kind of like a political, even though it's still surface.
Yes.
There is a political meaning to her. Like it's... She's engaging with feminism. She's engaging with the history of art. She's engaging in like what it means to be monstrous and beautiful. And yeah, and she's like engaging in this new way of looking at the body, whereas Stellark, it feels, even though he says it's like, oh, this is a new body, it doesn't quite work.
Right. And I think that Cronenberg is not sending up Orlan in this. That figure, the Odile figure, becomes really important for Caprice in accepting, you know, there's this really important moment, I think, where after she gets this body modification, after she gets cut up, after she says, I want it to be open, and that shocked me, Caprice says. After that, she says, I'm not innocent. I don't know, what is it that she says? Like, I'm not shy anymore, you know? And in a world in which public sex in form of surgery is happening all the time, and we're sort of blurring this like individual society, private public thing, that means that her art can go further.
And it's also a really important part, I believe, of the concept of the cosmetic gaze, which is something that I work with a lot in my own research. And it's from this book by Bernadette Wegenstein. And she writes about, and it definitely applies to Cronenberg, but she mostly writes about it. She writes about Orlan. She writes about like the plastic surgery reality shows, like The Swan, where these people get, you know, dozens of plastic surgeries and then emerge as this stereotypically beautiful person. But the cosmetic gaze to Wegenstein is, she writes, it means that there's a, quote, plane of potential that lies below the skin and is accessible only via the action of cutting. And so, you know, it means that our cultural understanding of what human bodies can be is invariably and unavoidably melded by the expectations and the possibility of bodily modification. And within that possibility, the fact that we can, as modern human subjects, you know, embodied modern human subjects, the fact that we can change our bodies also imbues this kind of moralizing gaze onto the cosmetic gaze, where if you're able to improve your body in that way, or if you're able to like cut into your body and change it in a way that would quote unquote improve it within society, that then it becomes like a moral imperative. And I kind of see that in Crimes of the Future, in that like these artists are pushing forward like small p politics in this kind of big moral and political and like conceptual way. They are taking the body into a higher plane of art and a higher plane of aesthetics, much like Wegenstein's cosmetic gaze is saying that is happening within the more plebeian world of like cosmetic surgery and body modification in our real world.
Totally.
So yeah, I think it's really, you know, this cosmetic gaze is like, okay, we can see in Cronenberg how seeing under the skin, that potential that Bekenstein is talking about in her book, in Crimes of the Future, it's not only like aesthetic possibility, but it's also sexual, creative, and post-human possibilities that are accessible under the skin. And that can be seen by others under the skin because of the way that this world is operating.
Absolutely. And it makes me think of this, like, okay, if in this film, body is reality, then cutting into the body is opening up the potentials of that reality, is what art does, is like, is not only showing us what that reality is giving us a vantage on that reality, but also unleashing more meanings than the art itself can contain, but meanings which, as you say, yes, can accelerate, can push us forward into certain states of being, including political states, perhaps before we can articulate it, before. Yeah, I think the film is super interested in meaning.
Yes.
Also, it's related to the autopsy.
And the body not only as reality, but also the body as text, like that is 100%. Legible in a very interesting way. Like there's, I think it's, so we're wrapping up with the last scene, the autopsy scene, or not the very last scene, but the last like big spoiler.
Climax
scene, yeah. And Caprice is doing the surgery. No, not the surgery. Well, I guess it is a surgery, but autopsy on Brecken, the boy's body. And she waxes like a literature professor. Like she starts talking about.
She literally says she's, professor of literature.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. She frames herself in that way as like, we are going to open this body, get into this plane of potential that is under the skin, this text to be read, these organs are lines, like, and then it totally thwarts her in the end, which I find interesting. And I'm not quite sure what to do with that, but it becomes this text that is actually not what she expected and illegible in a way. She still spins it to read it in a much more macro way. Like, oh, the government got to this body before us. Like, this is what degeneration really is. This world has imprinted even on its youth.
And she talks about like, this child was murdered by his mother because of the meaning that was hidden in his body. And she basically says, like, literature professors were going to search for the meaning that lies locked in the poem that was Brecken, that was this child.
Yes.
And you're so right that in that moment where she cuts open, that is why the cutting open is important, right? You might be expecting one thing, but what art does by cutting open is showing us possibly something else, something we might not be ready for, and then something we have to deal with and make meaning out of. Because one of the things I like about the artists in this film is they're not paranoid. Instead of trying to control the quote-unquote meanings of their art, they are open to those meanings getting taken beyond themselves. For instance, let's say what the art is doing is, okay, the body is reality, we're cutting into this and removing the organ, but what Timlin gets is surgery is the new sex.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
That is what art helps her to see.
The multivalent interpretations for each of the performances in this film is so clear. Like they're even from like what we were saying at the very beginning where you were like, oh, so I haven't read anything that David Cronenberg has said about his work, but this is my interpretation. Like that's inscribed in the film over and over again, that exact experience.
And I think explicitly by the fact that at the end of the film, the way I understood that quote unquote attempt to read the poem of the body was we're almost being given, let's say, the two poles of interpretation theory, of close reading theory, right? Like one is death of the author. Like there is no meaning except what you read into it. Mm-hmm. You know, Roland Barthes, like this idea that only interpretation matters, that there is no original meaning, you know. And then on the other hand, this almost deistic sense of like author intentionality, this like the only meaning you can get out of it is what the author explicitly intended. Yep. And I think in the end, the film falls somewhere between, somewhere into this like, well, let's cut open and see. And she says what art does is it maps the chaos inside. Let's create a map that will guide us into the heart of darkness. And she even says, we have to keep diving deep inside to find different answers. We need a second autopsy and a third.
Yes.
So like art is always doing this. Its role is never done.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So are we going to do a second and third episode about Crimes of the Future?
Maybe about Cronenberg.
Yeah.
I think I need a break from Crimes of the Future for a little while.